Yes, I did have the Moto 360 watch on my wrist for a while, but like all review hardware, eventually had to go back to the PR shop from whence it came. So I thought instead of me talking about my wearables, let's talk about yours. I see we have one here. Which wearables have you also thought about buying? Have you ruled out any so far?
I have one on that you can see.
Ooh.
Tim Lord made me come and talk about my wearables because he knows how much I love my Fitbit. Or maybe I just love the person who gave me my Fitbit, Tim. Ooh, mystery. I researched a bunch. There, I didn't think it was on. You're all lying to me.
Okay, that's much better. So, wearables. It's the quantified self, right? It's the future of the digital self. I want to know myself in all of my many aspects. I believe firmly, actually, in all seriousness, that these are great enablers of healthcare, of, you know, finding your children in a large crowd, of whatever the purpose to which you want to put it. What we're concerned about at CDT, obviously, are the boundaries on the data that is collected and the decisions that are thus made about you based on the data that you provide, knowingly or kind of unconsciously in some cases. But I think, again, let me start with the profound kind of impact. I was just at the doctor's office today, and I'm not joking when I say I'm wearing several wearables, not all of which are visible, and I was talking to him about this very topic, and he said, listen, Newell, the day is going to come when you will just have a little tattoo right there in the middle of your stomach, and it will tell me, the minute you walk into the room, what your blood pressure is, what your, you know, blood ox is, what your this and your that, and he named a whole bunch of other things, your heart rate, your whatever. I won't have to attach anything to you. I won't have to attach your electrodes for your EKG or whatever. You won't have to wear something externally visible. Anyone who's worn one of the wearable heart monitor things knows how annoying and uncomfortable they can be. But it will tell me everything right here on my computer without me even having to look at you, which of course is a breakdown of civilization because we're not actually looking at each other anymore. But even more, that data will be always on, always available. Now that's a great opportunity for healthcare. It's a great opportunity for, again, real time. He said, listen, we could intervene if we knew you were having a heart attack, you know, in the middle of the night. We could, you know, if you're being monitored in your real time life, we could send the paramedics, we could do whatever if we had that real time monitoring capability. But he gave another story, and I won't tell who the doctor is because it's kind of a funny personal story. He said, I was out to dinner with my wife not long ago, and she had just been to a doctor, not in his practice, but in his same network. And she said, you know, the doctor told me something I didn't entirely understand. And he said, well, I'll help clarify for you. And he picked out his iPhone in the middle of dinner, logged in, looked at a record, and said, oh, well, he told you this and this and this and this. And she was really excited, first of all, to have that explanation. And then he said there was a long pause. And they've been married a long time, and she knows exactly what he does, and he knows exactly what she does. But he said the realization that her records were completely available to me at all times. Now, I'm not going to do anything with them, and I take an oath, and I'm a responsible person, and I'm a professional. But the fact that anyone in the network could easily log in and see all of her data, and what if there was some medical condition she hadn't told her spouse about? So anyway, at the end of the story, he said, privacy's dead. There's no privacy left. And I said, well, no, doctor, that is my job. I'm here to fight for that. I'm not willing to concede that yet. Not today, not ever. However, I get your point that there's a heck of a lot of data out there, and what we need are good rules. You've profoundly imbibed as a good doctor what your rules are and where, how far you'll go and how far you'll use the data. What we need to create is, again, the boundaries of what the society we want to look like have, and that is the boundaries between you and me, the boundaries between me and the companies with which I do business, the boundaries between the self and the government. And that's really, you know, the self-definition of privacy is control, is trust, is defining oneself in this new society. Wow, that was a long-winded answer. I'm sorry, we're done. That's
So this next question is a three-part one. Part one, I have a long-winded question.
We're standing between these people and their
risky spot. Right now, so. Do you read the privacy policy for a new wearable device before buying it? To the end. Really?
Those are three parts of the question, thank goodness. I like to say I used to be the Mark Twain of privacy, right? I've written more words on privacy for more companies that have never been read. So the truthful answer, Did I read all the disclosures? No, but I make my children read them. Isn't that terrible? That is such a hypocritical answer. Yes, I read them not till the end. That's exactly right. And did I read the one for this one? Yes, but because I'm incredibly proud to say CDT is working with Fitbit on a number of projects on data collection and on creating good rules in this space. So.
Now, maybe an easier thing for people to contemplate is not so much the legalese of the privacy policy, although if you're trying to get a kid to go to sleep, maybe I should read that to my daughter at some point. The business models, do you factor that in, the business model behind the maker of a wearable gadget or the app that runs on it? How should people think about that?
Well, I think the profound promise is that my data will be used for the purposes that I understand when I sign up for the program, whatever that is. But they will not be used kind of against me, or I call it, you know, the primary purpose, the secondary and tertiary purposes. We don't expect, a profound bright line we at CDT would say is, we do not expect that the devices in our daily lives will generate data that will by default end up in the hands of the federal government or any government, right? That there should be a much more hard line between commercial data and government data. But even more in the commercial, setting outside the commercial space, the line between the primary purpose for the data collection and the secondary purpose or the marketing or the additional, I think, require a higher level of kind of input from the customer and disclosure. But I think that the more interesting question about privacy policies generally is really in the age of wearables, in the age of kind of always-on technology, and I hate the phrase the Internet of Things. You all know I've said that. It's the Internet of People. Right? It is you know, the Internet of Everything. It is the Internet of Everywhere. But are pros privacy policies dead? Like, I think that's actually the harder question. Is it completely irrelevant to the chain of custody, of the chain of your commercial transaction, to have to go outside of that initiative and read something in a narrative? I have to say, I have to promote, I think there's some people here from Amazon, my former employer, big fan of the embedded disclosure, partly because I helped write some of them before I left. Anyone who's bought a Fire TV knows that when you turn on the Amazon Fire TV, you plug the little box into the side of your television, a nice little cartoon character comes up and starts talking to you about where your data is going to go and how it's going to be used. That is embedded in the UBI, the out-of-box experience. It is part of the organic transaction between you and the company, and it is within the boundaries, and of course in all the jargon we use, real-time, you know, immediate and robust disclosure. But again, as these devices become less and less kind of language-based and more physical-based, how do we let people know what is happening to them? And that, I think that's the hard question, but I trust the great technologists and the great lawyers who are working at these great companies to get this right. I think that disclosure and customer trust is profoundly part of the data equation, and it is kind of on the part of the company to get these disclosures right. Otherwise, you do not want a surprised and dissatisfied customer on these issues.
And I think trust is probably the model a lot of people use. Like, I bought from Apple before. I like what they do. You know, I use Evernote. They said they're not a big data company. And I know people who used to work there who know the boss, so okay. But somebody's going to get this wrong. At what point do we see the first big privacy scare involving a wearable gadget? Or has it already happened?
I thought if you stop the sentence at the first big privacy scare, it'd be my old company, DoubleClick, right? So for those of you who are old enough in the room to remember, one of the first privacy settlements at the FTC, I'm not sure I'm aware of a big privacy scare with a wearable, but I think there are two sides of that. There's the intentional misuse, and then there's the accidental, you know, breach or disclosure, and both of those could signal a very, very significant loss of trust for any company. I mean, you've seen it in the offline world. I think the Target breach was the first one we've seen where footsteps actually left the store and didn't come back. And I actually think there's an underpinning to that narrative that most people haven't thought about. Sorry to get off the wearable subject for a minute. But it is, for the first time, a lot of real bricks and mortar shoppers said, well, I haven't seen a cyber attack in an online company. I mean, these bricks and mortar companies I've been going to and handing my credit card across the counter because I trust them because I'm looking at the cashier in the eye, can't be trusted to get their cyber right. But the great brand names online, whose kind of bread and butter work surrounds cybersecurity and systems security, maybe I'll give it a try. And I think there was a little bit of a tipping point in the trust versus the online-offline debate that we've all been having for decades. And but I do think one big misstep, especially for a nascent brand name, is all it could take to really, really be a death knell for a company.
Indeed. We're supposed to leave some time for a question or two from the audience. Shorter than the questions I've been asking. Do Do we have any? Or I can just make up one.
Not one question. They all really want to get to the happy hour.
Right, exactly. We have to talk Apple Watch. I think they won't actually let us off the stage unless we mention that.
Do you have one?
No.
You'd be wearing it.
I have an Android phone, so it would be a very useless watch.
That's right.
Maybe someone with an iPhone could hack into it for me.
You could connect to my Apple phone.
Right. And here we have a company that has been trying to say for the past couple of years, you know, we're not about monetizing your stuff. On the other hand, they've had one of the worst cloud security breaches when it turns out that an iCloud ID is not the most secured credential ever. Do you think they sort of processed and learned from that?
Well, I'm really grateful to the position that Apple's taken, particularly on the encryption and the backdoor issue, standing up to what we consider obviously excessive or exuberant law enforcement efforts. So I think you're right. People do put a lot of faith into big brand names online, but I think they're even harder on those big brand names if you get to a 10 and then you quickly lose faith if things go wrong. As far as the Apple Watch goes, I've been saying for years that the phone is the wrong word to use for these devices, so a watch is really the wrong word to describe that. I have a little Apple Watch envy. As you can see, I'm an early adopter. I love new technology, and I would love to have one. I asked Apple if I could model one on stage for the tech prom, and they didn't give me one. So anyway, in the room.
It would have been a good part
of the ensemble, but I do think I think companies do learn. In fact, a limiting thing I've seen in my time in the private sector is that companies only learn from their own mistakes or from ones in their own industry. What we really need is industries to kind of cross-pollinate. I had the privilege of doing some work at GE where you had 17 different industries, and we could try to force people to say, just because it happened in healthcare, it does not mean it's not going to happen in financial services or vice versa, and create best practices that worked across multiple sectors. I don't see that kind of learning happening. That data is data, and respect for a customer is respect for the customer, regardless of whether it is, your financial services, your date, your healthcare, your children's, your online television watching, as you've seen, your selfies, whatever. You can't decide for your customer what they consider is most sensitive. I think you need to consider it all part of their digital self and provide, there are certainly grades of levels of sensitivity, but customer data, I think, is among the highest and most sensitive. And if we had a culture within each company that rewarded that kind of behavior, that would be great. If not, I think we're looking at legislation down the line.
Indeed.
Question.
I guess we'll make that the last question then. Do we have any?
That one.
We have a question there. I know this guy.
Well, about your Internet of People idea. However, people have different expectations of different companies and different relationships with vendors and suppliers. How does that play out when there's currently no compatibility or interconnectivity that works in the Internet of Everything arena? So how do you see this playing out with the Internet of People?
That's a great question. I was just starting to build on that thought that when I say it's the Internet of People, I want companies, I want governments, I want all of us to think about the data is about a person. And I tried very hard when I was working in various companies to create analogies, because analogies are a great way for people to learn. And one of the analogies I used was data is the lifeblood of a company, or you should treat it like you would treat blood and keep it with the sensitivity and the chain of custody. For others, it's a monetary analogy. But really, where I've landed is that we don't necessarily have it right in the property law construct in this country. The Europeans probably don't have it entirely right either, as many of us would say. But Latin America has come up with has grown up with a construct of habeas data, or my data, myself. And if we could, again, encourage people to think about the data as part of the human. And again, it's a very human rights construct. I get that the language is hard for some people, but rather than focusing on the device, focusing on the devices serving us, and that they are serving individuals, and at the end of the day, my data is my data. I freely give it to share in the wealth of the digital economy or engage in the goods and services provided to me by great companies. But it is I ultimately have a right in it as a person. And so I want people to start thinking about the data they transact in that way. I think it gives us a little more kind of sense of dignity for the customer and the self.